Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance in the Crawl Space Studios in Wormtown. Lance, how are ya?
Doing very well. It's good to be here in Wormtown, as I've said previously, nestled in our little black box, but it's going to be fun to go to New Orleans soon.
It is. We're going to New Orleans this weekend for CrimeCon, and if you are on the fence still, A, what are you doing?
It's almost too late.
It really
is. Get off the fence.
Yeah, and B, just use code CrawlSpace19 and help yourself out, save 10%. So, Lance, this episode here today was recorded at our panel with Bruce Maitland, Greg Overacker, Lou Barry, and Chloe Cantor.
Yep, this was at the Riverwalk Cafe. It was our live show, our intimate engagement over there in Nashua, New Hampshire, last Wednesday, the 22nd of May, actually a couple Wednesdays ago. But yeah, it went really well. I want to thank everybody for coming out. Everyone got a lot out of it. I think a lot of people were very relieved to see Bruce speak about Brianna, and it was very interesting to hear the investigative process through Lou and through Greg. Big thanks to the Riverwalk. I'm going to fall on a sword and say I sort of dropped a ball because I thought that people like Bruce and Lou and Greg, they were very nervous about being on stage, so I brought these little lapel microphones. I thought that it might help them. They wouldn't have to worry about a microphone. Turns out that lapel microphones are not that good for PA broadcast. So the people over there at the Riverwalk, the employees, the staff, they did an excellent job compensating for a lack of volume, and we sort of made adjustments on the fly. But the audience stuck with us, and for the most part, it was the information that was really the most important part of everything.
Yeah, and the audio came out all right.
Yeah, the audio came out pretty good, despite.
There's some little blips here and there, but it's still pretty good and listenable. And this is actually going to be a 2-part episode, Lance. So part two will likely come out next week, and we'll probably do some comments on the video of this very episode. So if you want to leave a comment, we will likely read it in next week's intro.
Great. And we will be doing other shows at the Riverwalk. Let's just get through CrimeCon and start thinking about a show maybe in July or August.
Sounds good. So thank you very much for listening. Check us out on Patreon. We're doing weekly stuff there. Patreon.com/CrawlSpacePodcast. And check us out on Stitcher Premium. The entire CrawlSpace archive is there. StitcherPremium.com. Use promo code MMM. That stands for Missing More Murray, which is one of our other podcasts.
Sort of the flagship one, and pretty easy to remember.
Thank you very much for listening.
I'm Greg. I'm a private investigator. I got involved with Brianna's case. Father's Day of 2006, I saw Brianna's poster on the New York State Thruway. And I contacted Class Kids, who are, they did the original searches for Brianna.
Yeah.
And they put us in touch, and that's kind of how that came to be. You'll recognize Class Kids from Polyclass, obviously. Mark Kloss started Class Kids, and he did the original searches and put us in touch. I originally met Bruce and Kelly in Gouverneur, New York, when they had moved out of Vermont. We kind of went from there.
Okay, thanks. Okay. And Bruce Maitland, how are you tonight?
All right, I'm doing all fine. Right. Yeah. Thanks for having me down. I mean, I'm Brianna's dad, and most of you know her story. I'll be happy to answer questions at some point when it comes to that time if you have anything specific you want to know. But, Brianna went missing after work. A car was found, and, she hasn't been found since. These guys have been a godsend to me. You know, they've helped me out and done a lot for me over the years. When I met Greg, I certainly didn't trust him.
I still don't.
I had a lot of PIs, wannabe PIs is probably a better word, that kind of came different times. And, when I finally figured out kind of Greg was the real deal, that's just kind of took off, and we've come to trust each other. And when Lou came on, Lou's been absolutely indispensable too, with his police skills and clear thinking, and it's just been really nice to me to have a couple of guys that are willing to put their time and energy into helping me out.
So you said you had some private investigators approach you in the early days, but Greg kind of has obviously stuck with you and must have shown something different to you. And I guess, can you identify what that is?
He's willing to get in trouble.
Willing to get in trouble?
Pretty much.
Yeah. Willing to do pretty much everything I've asked him so far. It's kind of the typical private investigator line is people come up and say, well, I think I can solve this for you. Tell me everything you know. And that's just kind of mind-boggling in a way. And I've done that a few times where you've kind of poured out pretty much a lot of to get someone started. And, a week later when it can't be solved in 5 minutes, they're gone. And I think some of that is probably the TV culture where they just think, there's just some easy missing piece that somebody hasn't covered, and it just doesn't work that way in
real
life.
That's actually the first thing we know when someone's not credible.
What's the first thing?
When they say, we'll figure this out. Don't worry, we'll figure it out.
And then you'll almost expect them to leave at some point?
They're going to get the information and go, ta-da. It doesn't work that way.
And what about Lou? When Lou came on, what was it about Lou that made you realize he was here to stay and can make a difference?
Oh, Lou just kind of proved himself from day one. I don't know how else to really put that.
He's got some experience.
Yeah. I don't know.
I think I told Bruce the first time we met him the chances of solving this are probably very, very slim.
We get it.
We're willing to give it a shot anyways.
I'm a podcaster without a microphone. I was dying.
Okay. So should we talk a little bit about private investigations for the missing?
Yeah, I think we should get into private investigations for the missing. And Bruce, if you want to explain how that started and what your overall goal is.
Greg and I started talking about it, and actually I think it was probably your idea initially. And we started talking about this because you run into a situation where when someone goes missing, I mean, the first thing a lot of people have don't take this wrong, Lou, but you have an opinion that the police are there to help you out. And I had never interacted with the police before all this happened in my entire life. And you think that, they're going to actually help you solve it and find your daughter. And after a number of initial difficulties of that sort of thing, you come to a situation where the leads are either slow or have dried up completely, and you're left as someone that will do practically anything in the world to find your daughter. Your option then is really you have two options. You can go interview people by yourself. Which I found out pretty quickly after doing that a number of times with with some different circumstances that happened that I really don't want to go into public with. That's a really dumb idea, because you're emotionally involved in a large sense, and words get passed, and things happen. And so you're left with trying to find someone that has a little bit of a sense of detachment to be able to do interviews and be able to think a little more logically in that, in the aspect, than you as a parent is able to. And so we talked about this for, 2 years?
Yeah, wow.
I think. And I wasn't really emotionally ready to do it. I've kind of concluded. And quite frankly, I'm still not sure I'm 100% emotionally ready to do it. But we decided to go ahead and go forward with it anyhow, because people need help out there. Because if you're not a really, really wealthy person, you cannot afford to have a private investigator come out and do that kind of work. I mean, it would just destroy you financially, because there's so many avenues that they have to work. So
it's not that the police don't want to help. It's just that they're the police. They're busy. They're constantly pulled away. They have a heavy burden. And you expect someone to be looking for your daughter every day. And for that to happen, it takes money. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have to travel to Vermont. There's hotels, there's gas, there's paperwork, there's food, and it's overwhelming. So,
okay, so I think that might come to a more greater question. Why do these cases fall off the priority list, and what does a private investigator provide when the cases aren't up on the priority list as high as the family members would want them to be?
Good question for you, Lou.
Yeah.
Well, you know, crime doesn't stop, and you get a case, you know, for instance, like this, that draws a lot of publicity and notoriety in the beginning, but as time goes on, you know, investigations like this can be tedious, because you're contacting witnesses or potential witnesses or whatever can take a lot of time and travel. And over periods of time, other things happen, and you only have so many resources, and you can't spread yourself too thin. And other cases tend to take priority, and you know, the cases that you're not making any progress on tend to fall behind. And not that that's a good thing, but it's a reality. I think every department has limited resources to one extent or another. The advantage of a private investigator is they are working on a particular case. They can devote their time to that. The downside is obviously they don't have the resources that a official department, a police department does, a municipality does. Yet, on the other hand, I've found, and I think Greg will echo this, that many people are reluctant to speak to the police for one reason or another, maybe a bad experience, or they don't really want to become involved officially. Yeah. But they will speak to us, and I've found that a number of times in this particular case also, that people have said, why didn't you, well, you knew this information, why didn't you come forward with it? Well, I didn't want to bother them, or I don't want to talk to them, or whatever. So,
and even people who know that you're former law enforcement are still more likely to come to you than...
It seems that way. I've had pretty good luck with people coming in with information, some of which... you know, is relatively fresh in the sense that they've never told anybody this before, and they have all sorts of reasons why not. But you know, we're still 14 years later, still getting information, fresh information.
Can you imagine initially when everyone was looking for Brianna, and then it starts to die down, and every day you get up and you go to work, and everyone's going about their day like nothing has happened, and the police are directing traffic, and you're thinking, why aren't they looking for my daughter? Why isn't the world stopped? Was that what you initially went through, kind of?
I pretty much quit working for 2 months.
Yes.
You know,
and you wonder why hasn't everybody stopped and helped?
But every time they're doing something of less value, it's like, my gosh, you know?
Yeah, why aren't they doing this? But they can't.
Why aren't you doing this?
It's just too much.
The other aspect of Bruce's nonprofit is to help out families. As he said, very, very few people have the financial resources to hire a private investigator to work for them. And, you know, I'm in a fortunate position where I can do it for nothing, and I think Greg has volunteered his time for nothing over the years. But
you know, obviously, not everybody can do that. Not every private investigator wants to do that. They have to make a living, obviously, so they can't work for nothing.
How much do they usually charge a private investigator?
I would say it would probably depend, but $100 an hour would not be unusual. And even the expenses, like trips to Vermont, staying overnight one or two nights, you meals, you add all that up, gas, and it becomes...
It gets deeper than that, too. I mean, I lived alone for years. I would just get in my car and drive up there and just live in hotels. But I could do that. I didn't have a family to come home to have to... I wasn't interrupting anyone else in my life.
You would just do that spontaneously, take a trip up there?
Well, if we had something going on we wanted to do, get in my car and go.
Yeah.
And you do this on your own dime?
He paid expenses, yeah.
Right.
Interested, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So I take a few days off from work and go.
What about tips? Is every tip valuable? Have some value?
I wish it did. And that's part of the process is weeding out the wheat from the chaff. And it's, you don't want to discount anything, no matter how unlikely it might sound, because that could be the tip that solves it. But, that could be very frustrating, too, when you spend a lot of time on things and find out that that's...
He's very used to this. I'm not. I am now, to getting calls from people that are just certifiable and tell you things that are just don't make any sense whatsoever, why they want to interject themselves, or people that will honestly send you on a goose chase.
Well, so that really speaks to like a cultural thing that we're experiencing now in, doing what we do, and we have a lot of people who reach out to us, and I think Tim and I sort of have a sixth sense for when you're reading an email and you get into a certain part of the email and you're like, oh my God, this is like, if you have an email on your phone and you start scrolling and scrolling, you're like, okay, this is crazy.
And talking about Jimmy Hoffa.
Right. They're talking of it and everything is connected and everything is, they're trying to make sense of one, one thing that probably is so arbitrary. And that's just us as like not professionals. I can't imagine what it's like for, first of all, law enforcement, but
it's hard when it's going to cost you money and time and emotion and all that other stuff. And everybody kind of connects more with Brianna, which we don't know. We've always left it on the table, but they're superficially they're the same. But once you go deeper, they're a lot different.
Okay, so for anyone who doesn't know that, Maura Murray disappeared about a month before Brianna. Very similar circumstances with the vehicle being left on the side of the road. At some point, though, you just have to say that this is... it's not connected, and it is just a matter of two very similar circumstances over the course of a short duration.
Yeah, because they're up where they are in a sparsely populated area, they've always been related from that in the time frame.
But that doesn't stop people from trying to make the connections between the two, and if you're looking at it so deeply, you start seeing things that aren't there, right?
Yeah, it's an odd thing. And we don't know, but we've always left it open, but... there's a lot of differences.
Yeah. How many of those moments have you had where someone has reached out to you, either any one of the three of you, where you say, I know this, in the back of my head, I know this is not legit, but what if? Like you...
Yeah, we have to look.
You have to follow up on it. Do each one of you have experiences like that?
It happens, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we did a tip campaign 2 years ago in Burlington, and... some of the stuff we got was very useful. Some of it was like, I saw a van 30 miles away with a guy and a girl in it 2 weeks after that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it could be connected. Okay, thank you. And you get a lot of things like that where people in their minds think, make this connection.
I just can't imagine the police, how many tips they must have had like that. It must have just been overwhelming.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure. And any case like that receives this type of notoriety is going to get...
yeah.
A lot of, and the sad thing is, you can't discount anything because, one of them could be accurate.
Yeah. Right, and a tip like that, where it's kind of random, does it seem like there's something more that the person wants to share, or is it just random?
That was it. Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah. When you follow up with them, that's, and you're kind of like waiting for more, there is no more.
Yeah, nothing.
The other, I think, frustrating thing is, and Greg and I have talked about this, whenever you have a case that has no obvious answers, there's always this small segment of people saying, oh, it's a police cover-up. And
it's a default position.
Over and over on different cases.
Your mind wants to have an answer.
Yeah.
It's a default.
When you don't have an answer, you go to a default position, and that's usually the police. So well, the police were there. Well, yeah, they were there. They're the police. You know, like in Morris' situation. That's been kind of a big thing, and I don't want to go into that. Get people pissed off at me. But, you know, the kind of insinuated that the police were involved because the police were on the scene, and there's a very small gap of time that's unaccounted for in the police logs. Well, the police were on the scene because they're the police. I don't know how else to go into that, but...
Yeah, you're saying the police were on the scene because they're the police and they were called.
If you've got something else to back that up, that's different.
Right.
Yeah.
I think people just see that as a explanation that explains why something makes no sense. Oh,
well it's hearing a noise in the woods and thinking it's Bigfoot. Well, maybe it is Bigfoot. I don't know. But there's a lot of things
logic.
That make noises in the woods.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those situations.
Well, as a private investigator, how do you train your brain to not think like that?
I don't know. I just see.
Well, you have a very logical way of thinking.
If
you have
I was
going
to point my finger at the police, at anybody, I want something to back it up. And especially the police were there to help, and there's just nothing to back it up. If there was, I'd be the first to jump on it. And it's happened. I mean, there's cases of it happening. So,
but in cases like this, there are so many agencies involved at so many different levels that it would be almost impossible. You know, when the FBI is involved, the state police are involved, the district attorney's involved, the state's attorney's involved, and the local police are involved. It's just too many, you know, cover-ups like that just don't occur.
The general rule of thumb in the conspiracy is the more people involved, the less likely it is to happen, less likely it is to be true, and less likely that someone's going to keep it quiet, or be able to keep it quiet.
Yeah, so the more people who know, the less likely it is to be the case, and in Moore's case, It would have to go all the way.
I don't know a ton about Morris's case, but who was the police officer that they were insinuating was involved? Was it?
I don't even know to tell you the truth.
It's
numerous. Yeah.
Many people have.
Yeah.
Many just, different officers it, have been.
I thought it was someone in particular.
But that's a good question because.
Does anybody here know?
No, I mean Yeah, I mean I don't think there's any like one definitive theory out there for that because. I think it's
there were people there
by
on the
nature
scene watching. I mean, there was a neighbor. There was a few neighbors, right? If that's something like that was going to happen, that's a pretty dicey situation to try to do something like that.
Well, even in Brianna's case, it was mentioned. You know, that the first officer that saw the car. See, it must they didn't do anything. It must be a cover up.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's just
it's a default. Position.
It just yeah, exactly.
So. Okay, so can you take us to the beginning of Brianna's case, as far as the first officer, I mean, who found the car, and how did you figure out that this was Brianna's car? And can you take us back to that and your interaction with law enforcement in the beginning?
Well, the first officer on the scene came by, on the following day.
Right.
And
because Brianna was staying with a friend.
Yeah, I mean,
and she was out of town. No one was alerted right away.
Nobody really knows. The officer took down some basic information. You probably heard most of the story, and he slapped it in his notebook, called for a tow truck, and went home for a long weekend.
That's huge too, because the car was registered to Kelly, right?
Yes, the car was registered. So my first contacts with police were just I was livid. You know, the whole situation for weeks and months, it was almost a battle with the police is more than it was, any kind of a helping hand. And I don't want to go into a lot of that. I've had a lot with the police, and they've done some great work. And, you know, afterwards, two former heads of the Vermont State Police are on this board. So that tells you that some of the people there, that the esteem that I kind of hold some of these people in. And so,
they wholeheartedly admit that they made mistakes initially. And those people are gone.
Yeah, that was probably one of the best things that happened is the guys that were there earlier retired out. and they just had preconceptions that, were not true and just different things happen in that. But kind of getting back to the private investigators, I mean, when I tried to put this board together, I mean, I spent a lot of time putting the board together, and thankfully I got these two guys on it. So that's
been
absolutely great. But you know, the two, some of the duties of Tom Lesperance and Jim Baker, the two former heads of Vermont State Police, is that when we start to reach out to people to be able to help them with their cases, we want to have qualified people doing it. I don't want other people to go through the same thing with I do with investigators that are going to walk up and say, I'm going to help you solve this, or people that are quasi-investigators. So part of their job is to actually going to be to look at the people that are the investigators and do some pre-screening and make sure that the people that are doing going to be doing the workforce are good, qualified people. And then the combination of, and Lou will attest to that, I mean, you know, you've got to be, when you go into a case, you've got to be able to work with the local police to some aspect. And this is what I'm hoping that those guys, you know, will be able to form that bridge.
Which has been an issue with Morris,
you know,
kind of. I think there's been tension there between the police and the family.
Yeah, for sure, in Morris.
And it's not helping.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So that's a pretty decent comparison, I guess, when you look at the relationship that you've maintained with law enforcement in Vermont. Right. I mean, mm-hmm. that was a decision on your part to keep that relationship going, even though they did not address it immediately as efficiently as they should have.
Well, I mean, when those guys retired out and Jim Baker came in as the head of Vermont State Police, they came out to my farm, sit down at the table with my family, and we had a long discussion about everything that happened and Greg says they wholeheartedly admitted, well, hey, Connor, you know, yeah, whatever, but... You know, but I mean, the end result was things did change, and it changed. They made some huge procedural changes in the way that they did things from here on out, and I could see that. You know, there were two guys there sitting across the table from me that really wanted to help and to make changes.
The first, not identifying the car, was just huge, because it causes this huge gap in time. And if you look at how angry Fred was about different things in Morris' case, but I can't imagine how angry he must have been. I mean, that caused a four-day gap for a simple thing. Just got cars off the road, crashed.
Yeah.
Contact a registered owner. That would have eliminated all that. It would have been like, what, a 14, 15-hour time frame instead of 4 days. So that was huge.
But you come to a realization at some point even the private investigation guys can only go so far. They can develop a lead, they can talk to all the people, they can bring it all up. But in the end, the police are the government authority. They're the only ones that are going to make arrests and put the cuffs on people and see anything happen.
We're just gathering information.
Yeah.
They're going to do the work, you know.
So when you gather the information, you hand it off
Absolutely.
To the appropriate authority?
It's like faith. You just have to trust that they're going to do it.
Have you ever had a moment difficult. Where you've wanted to do something on your own?
Yeah, all the time.
I know.
You don't want to backdoor them, but, you know,
right.
to hand over information that you think is really, really good and just walk away is hard to do. But, you know, they follow up with Bruce and let him know that they've worked it and stuff like that.
Oh, so they do follow up with Bruce?
Yeah, for the most part.
They do in a certain sense. I mean, we've had... I laid out rules over the years that they've kind of agreed with, and we kind of worked on some certain things in Brianna's case. And I guess two of the rules are, if they've got a lead on something and I don't know about it, and I'll give you an example here. I mean, they had a prisoner contact them probably about 2 years ago, and he says, I know where Brianna's buried. I can take you right out and show her where she is. So they get the guy out of jail, and they... go to where it is, and lo and behold, he just wants a day to get out of jail. You know,
yeah.
Well,
literally wants to just smoke cigarettes.
I don't need to know about that.
Yeah.
So that's what I pretty much we kind of talked about even before that happened. Is like, I don't need to know about those leads. But if we,
The other leads are what I consider to them, I call them my leads. And that's any leads that these guys develop or develop in any way that we give to them. And, you know, we've come to the agreement that if it's my leads, then I need to know about it. I want to know every aspect that can possibly be released. So that's one of the things you kind of work out with them.
I'd say that's very admirable. You're able to transfer that anger into something more productive. What was that journey like for you?
Can you just clarify that a little bit?
I guess, how were you able to personally transfer that anger into something more productive?
Anger at who?
The police.
The police. And everything, I guess?
It takes years. And it still flares up. You know, I mean, I still have frustrations with them when, and it basically comes down to, you know, if I have a good lead and it doesn't get checked out quick enough, well, I get angry at that. But I don't know, you just kind of learn to deal with it. It's just, I don't know.
I think they understand, too, to a degree, you know, the frustration.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. It's difficult because the police are used to, you don't share information with.
Yeah, we understand that.
And
one-way street.
Yeah, it's a one-way street, yeah, and even now it's a one-way street. We give them information, and it's the ball's in their court at that point.
Yeah.
So you got to understand that's the way it is. That's all.
Yeah.
But you and I, we can't do anything. I mean, we can find someone, we can get information, we can give it to them. But as far as any prosecution goes or making a case, that's their job, not ours.
You know, and it's upsetting to them too because people tell us stuff that they'll never tell them.
And then so you can get an account and then give it to them, and then the police can go follow up. And then
and that's
going
to be frustrating for them because they can talk to the same person and not get that information.
Why did you decide to get into being a private investigator? Because it sounds extraordinarily frustrating.
I was already doing all that work. I worked for bail bondsmen. I was a repo guy at a process serving business. And I did all three of them at once because one was make a living off of all three kind of thing, and everybody knew everybody and all that. And when I started working for Bruce, it's something I wanted to pursue.
Did you have your PI license before you worked for Bruce?
Bounty hunters work under PI licenses in different states.
Okay.
Every state's different, yeah.
And how often do you work with private investigators, Lou?
Now?
No, during your career in law enforcement. How common is that to get?
As little as possible.
Yeah, you know, there's generally, they do their thing, we do our thing, and there wasn't a lot of mix in between.
Did you ever have any moments where you're like, I have this information that I'd really like to share with this licensed private investigator because you liked them, but you knew as a cop you couldn't do that?
No.
Has that changed? Has that culture changed at all over the years?
No, I understand. The police have, you know, they have responsibilities that the private investigator doesn't. So it's, you know, it's we're basically trying to do the same thing, but we answer to different parties. And I work for Bruce, and I, you know, when I do something and maybe the police aren't real thrilled about it, I said, I'm sorry, but I'm working for him. I'm not working for you. And when they do something I'm not happy about, they're not working for me. They're a Bruce. They're working for the state. So you gotta understand that. And once you understand that, you can get along and you do your own thing and share information when you can and not share it when you can't. You know? So
it's unfortunate that in Vermont, I think that they're just spread so thin that they're overburdened. I mean, and you have to take that into account and feel kind of bad for them for that.
Okay, so that's a big question about the capacity of these small town precincts or small town law enforcement. In Brianna's case, you have a car that's backed into the side of a house, and the arriving officer just assumes. I guess it might be unfair to say that he assumed that it was somebody who was drinking and just spun out and went.
Lou and I see this completely differently, but. If you know cops, if you hang around a cop or you know a lot of cops, cops see weird stuff all the time,
right.
Every day. I've seen a lot of weird stuff, cops do it every day. How many people have seen Brianna's car crashed into the house? You seen the pictures? If you drove past that, wouldn't you think that was strange?
Yeah.
So what happened here? No. But, you know, Lou said, drunk drivers do that all the time, and cops see that. We don't.
Yeah. And, you know, northern Vermont, in that particular area, any of you are familiar with it, there's not a lot of law enforcement presence up there.
Yeah.
And if you are at night and you get into an accident and you wait for the police, you could be there quite a while. So I think people may have a tendency to say, well, I'll leave and deal with this in the morning. And so as a result, it's not unusual. I mean, the way the accident happened was unusual, obviously. But the fact that there's been an accident and the car's been abandoned, I don't think is, you know, anything that you would say is extremely out of the ordinary up there.
I think when you look at, like, Maura's case, I would be worried that she had a head injury. That would, the first thing that would pop into my head, this crack in the windshield, she's got a head injury. Where did she go? She was just here.
Yeah, and just getting back to Brianna's for a minute, on his behalf, he did try, he went to the Black Lantern because there was some indication that she worked there because of the paycheck.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't open. You know, he went on about his day and then went on days off. So he made a half-hearted effort anyways to identify what happened. And, you know, it's unfortunate just the chain of circumstances that, you know, she was living with another person who didn't come home that weekend and didn't see the note. So, what, 2 days, 3 days went by before she was even considered to be missing.
And that's where that gets odd for Brianna's case, too, is because if you look at Brianna statistically, she's looked at as a child because of her age, but the way she was living was more as an adult.
Right. She was 17, right?
She was 17, yeah.
Okay.
But, I mean, she was living more as an adult. But if you look at statistically about child abduction and things like that, in that age group, she just kind of doesn't fit properly.
Right.
I will share one thing, too, though, was the difference between, like, the police and the public. And, I mean, people realize that, but they realize this, but they don't think about it. It's like, when it came time, right off, when things happened, it's just like, the police can't just go into a place and search it. Oh, right. They've got to get a warrant. They've got to get permission. But when you go up there, and we were doing searches over huge expanses of forests and farms and other things. I mean, as private citizens, we just went in and did it. I mean, there's no, and I mean, when the class kids came up to kind of help me organize the search, I mean, we organized in a group of people, and it's like out on the private property. If someone tells you that they don't want their property searched, come back and tell us.
Yeah.
So we can send a different group of guys out there or something and search it again, you know, or search it. So it's just so many things like that that they're constrained with. I mean, I remember I went to the Black Lantern Inn, spoke to the owners, spoke to the cook, and, you know, I said, I'd like your phone number list of everybody that made a call in and out of here. And they said, sure, we'll give it to you. Then they made an arrangement. The next day I had the phone list. You know, I took that down to the police. And, I mean, at that time, Lieutenant was livid at me.
Well,
how in the world did you get this?
That was another issue.
Well, we're not supposed to do that right away. And I said, well, I just asked the people for it. They gave it to me.
Yeah.
You know, but we can't use this because it wasn't properly, you know. And I mean, so, but as a private investigator, you can walk in, you could ask questions, and you can do things that,
yeah,
they're not.
I'll ask
you
if I know the answers.
One of the things that I say from time to time is that private investigators don't have to worry about a little thing called the Constitution.
Yeah.
So that does give us a little bit of an advantage sometimes when it comes to doing investigations.
They can only take your birthday away for trespassing. That's it. How many days before the police went to the Black Lantern, the place she was last known to be?
Oh, I'm not sure, but it was at least probably 10 days.
So that's the second huge, huge thing that caused a rift. Yeah. And how is that even possible? That's the last known place she was at.
Because they had their so-called groupthink was that she was a runaway.
Absolutely. So, and that was put out right to me. Oh, well, she probably ran away. She'll call you back in 3 or 4 or 5 days. So
when kids run away, they crash their cars first.
And leave paychecks in their car.
And run away. Yeah.
But it's common in cases like this where, maybe not so much now, we've looked at them a lot differently, but the organization will develop a theory, and that's the theory. That's what they go with. Instead of doing you know, what we recommend now, doing multifaceted, okay, you think it's a runaway, fine, but it's also looking at the option it might be an abduction or something, and, you know, going in different directions instead of everybody going in the same direction.
And even in the worst case scenario, if we don't want to get sued, okay, as long as you go do it. But that was the second thing that caused mistrust, am I correct? That was the second thing, waiting 10 days to go or 12 days to go to the lantern.
Well, there was just so many things during that two-week period that I wouldn't know which was the first or the second.
That's where you were at, right?
Yeah.
Is explaining.
You're the official historian for most of that as far as keeping track of that. So, yeah.
How many days till you find out? She goes, Friday she leaves work. Saturday the officer spots the car. 12 hours later, after she leaves work. Jillian calls you on Tuesday?
Monday?
Yeah, Monday.
You go to the police on Tuesday?
On Tuesday, yes.
But
well, the police said, we first went to the police, they said, well, you know, she's probably gone off somewhere. And at that time, we didn't know the car was where it was. We didn't know anything about the car. So all we know is we don't know where Brianna is or the car. So he says, well, she's probably gone off somewhere. We'll put an APB out on the car. And then come to find out, they had the car. They had already had it towed, but it was still in that officer's notebook.
But they didn't know that they had it. They didn't make the connection.
That officer knew that he had the car.
Knew that he had Brianna's car.
But he was the only one.
No, he didn't connect.
He didn't make the connection.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
When do you officially find out? When you go to the trooper barracks? Which is what, Wednesday?
It's probably actually Wednesday or Thursday. Yeah. Even. Yeah.
And the officer's there.
And the officer happens to be there. And, you know, we describe the car and he says, oh, wait a minute. And he goes, takes us in the back and he opens up and there's the picture of the car that you see against the building.
So he did take photos?
He took a photo.
You thought it was odd enough to take a photo?
Well, I think any abandoned car they find, they probably snap a photo of it, right?
What about an accident report or anything like that? Was anything like that done?
I don't know the answer to that question.
I don't know either, but I doubt it because it wouldn't probably be done until they located the owner. In this case, it's an abandoned house.
Which, again, they could have done by tracing the registration.
Mm-hmm. What about an accident recreation or anything like that? Has there ever been any thoughts on
that? Once the car goes to a tow yard and then there's contamination after that, people go in there.
Yeah, you do a reconstruction at the time. It's kind of hard to put one together. Unless, you know, there's some forensic evidence, there's skid marks or something. In this case, it was just a few marks in the grass.
And
a mark on the foundation where the bumper had hit, and that's about it. So.
Okay. Yeah, and you mentioned forensics. Do we know that there's any DNA found in the car or anything potentially belonging to the perpetrator?
Yeah, how much work has been done inside the car?
From the photographs, it appears as though they've taken upholstery pieces or whatever, and they have said that there's been DNA, but the relative worth of that is, you don't know.
When a person goes missing, their loved ones often find themselves overcome with worry and grief. Bruce Maitland started the 501c3 nonprofit organization Private Investigations for the Missing because he knows this feeling all too well.
When Bruce's daughter Brianna disappeared in March 2004, he was surrounded by licensed private investigators dedicated to finding her. Now his mission is to provide dedicated private investigators at no cost to other families of the missing, desperate for answers but without the financial means.
Private Investigations for the Missing needs your help. To read the mission statement, make a donation, and keep up with our blog, visit us at investigationsforthemissing.org and follow us at PI for the Missing on Twitter and Facebook and Investigations for the Missing on Instagram.
Because forever is too long to wait.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.